The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we come today after the Federal Reserve Chairman talked and, well, I guess he gave some hope to the markets, but let me back up a little bit. The last couple of days, the stock market, the Dow, was down 634 points. And then, of course, we get our 429-point rebound because I guess everything was better, but I've been listening to Bloomberg. I've been listening to BBC. I've listened to CNBC. I'm listening actually to high-pitched voices either freaking out or trying to sell America that everything's just fine and this was just an aberration. But what I'm asking you is this. What should we do? We're getting questions from our clients. Is there anything different that we need to do from the triangle? Anything different that we need to do today that we weren't doing yesterday? That's my question, Dave.
Well, I think investing is often the art of anticipation. I mean, where you are connecting dots before you're in the context of pressure or crisis, and you don't have to react or make radical changes in the context of crisis to the degree that you've been doing a forward-looking project to begin with. So we find ourselves pretty calm and quiet around here. What you've described as protocol, that's what we've followed. What we look at as a reference point in terms of the perspective triangle, which you alluded to just a moment ago, where you have a balanced approach to your paper assets on the one hand, which would be securities related, your dollar denominated or liquid assets on the other hand.
Right. And then the insurance.
Right? The insurance component, precious metals. You know, we began to see the market sell off earlier this week. And the beauty is the perspective triangle worked quite well. You had metals up, not a small fraction, but at one point, actually an overnight trade, if you combined both the day and then the overnight trade in Asia, over $100 an ounce on gold.
A huge move, and a lot of it happened while the Americans were sleeping.
In the context of the Dow peeling off 5.5%.
Right.
Lo and behold, you look at that perspective triangle, a very simple approach to allocating assets, in where you have stronger risk components, you also have those risk components offset.
Right.
And that's the beauty. We don't have to know exactly what's going to happen. And here's the thing. We're not making uninformed decisions on that basis. We're making very informed decisions because there's a whole host of things that we do know based in history, based in what some have derisively called, Kevin, something anachronistic or too old to be of any relevance. And what we're really talking about is a historical insight into the marketplace.
You're talking about the barbaric metal in a way, right? I mean, when you're saying, well, you know, that's not really part of the plan. But, you know, Dave, and I don't mean to cut you off here, but the stock market, it seems that everybody watches that to see how things are going. But in reality, that's just a small fraction of an overall portfolio. Now, just to let the new listener know, what we're talking about here, the older listeners, our clients, they understand. I mean, it's in their blood at this point. It's a third in gold and silver. It's a third in growth types of assets. And it's a third in cash so that they can pay. It's a triangle that, you know, it doesn't always have to be exactly thirds, but there's a balance there. And there's times when you rebalance the triangle, but you rarely ever would rebalance the triangle when there's a panic in the market because you're already set up for, you're padded against those kinds of reactions.
It's unnecessary. It's like having insurance and having a policy pay. You don't buy insurance, for instance, fire insurance, with, you know, a forest fire rolling over the hill next to the house.
Right.
You do that when there's no concerns, no considerations, and it's a theoretical risk that you're addressing. You know, nothing really changed. I think what is rapidly changing, Kevin, is the perception of the marketplace of the value of paper assets versus real things. In this case, gold particularly. I look at the Dow gold ratio with some frequency, and we've reached new lows for this move. On the Tuesday trade, with the equity market down and gold up, we saw 6.26 on the Dow gold ratio.
Well, and that's amazing because I remember 10 years ago talking to clients and saying, now listen, the Dow gold ratio, which is just simply dividing the value of the Dow Jones Industrial Average by the price of an ounce of gold. You know, when the Dow was 12,000 and gold was 300, the simple math basically tells you that that's a 40-to-1 ratio.
And the issue, Kevin, is this, because certainly the concern we find in our own chests is, at $1,750, at $2,000, at $2,500.
Sure, we think in dollars.
And that seems like a very high price to pay.
Yeah.
Kevin, it's just critical to turn that around and say price is not what we're looking at. It's this exponential purchasing of another asset, in this case, the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Which is something of real value. Now, we're not saying go put all your money in the Dow, but let's face it, that is the backbone of America. I mean, you're purchasing businesses in America, which no matter what kind of ups or downs we're going to have, it's probably not going to go back to Mad Max caveman days. We'll probably still have companies that actually buy and sell things.
Yeah, and I'm not a fan of General Electric. With this next comment, I don't want to be construed as a GE fan, but it is one of the Dow components which has been around for over 100 years. It's
sure.
the only remaining original Dow component.
Thomas Edison's company.
And, yeah. you know, the fact that they're half financial, half industrial today is maybe a disappointment. It certainly is what fed their profits and whatnot for at least the last 15, 20 years.
Right.
Here's the issue. Beginning of the decade, a modest sum, $30,000, would have bought 500 shares of GE.
Or 100 ounces of gold.
Or 100 ounces of gold. Today,
right.
your $30,000 in GE shares would be worth less, quite a bit less, about two-thirds less. GE shares aren't selling at $60 a share anymore. They're selling at $16.
Mm.
And there's real sadness in that, unless you were the person who chose to own the 100 ounces of gold instead, in which case today you're exchanging the same original value in terms of those ounces of gold, not for 500 shares of General Electric, but for over 11,000 shares of General Electric. And this is the point, Kevin. Gold preserves your purchasing power during periods of duress, whether that's in dollar terms that you're purchasing or in terms of real things, whether you're translating that value into houses or acres or shares or bond certificates. I mean, Kevin, this is where I don't care what the asset is in question.
Right.
But we do have to have some relevant relative value equation upon which to make clear decisions, because price becomes irrelevant in the case of an unstable.
Well, let's face it, the dollar is shifting sand. The euro is shifting sand. I mean, the Asian currencies are shifting sand. We've brought this out in the past. We are completely on what is called a fiat currency system, which means they just print more. Now, you know, without going into too great of an analysis, what Bernanke said, okay, was that we're not going to raise interest rates until the middle part of 2013. What he's basically saying is here's some free money for another, couple of years.
The temptation is this, Kevin, and I think why I started the conversation today with the Dow gold ratio and the perspective triangle is that there's really only a couple of things that people need to focus in on, right? And the white noise in the markets, which would include an even significant announcement from the FOMC.
Right.
It's insignificant because of what's already in play in the marketplace.
Well, David, you're talking about noise, and you know, the noise doesn't just come in the stock market. It can also come in the metals markets. You know, things, when they start skyrocketing, you start hearing, oh, it's never been so high, and this is the time to get out. But that actually can be noise too, because there's an overall trend, there's an overall plan, and this is my question. Do you have an end game strategy? Is there an exit strategy or a reallocation strategy? And would you restate what that would be?
Oh, we do. We absolutely do. The question is, do our listeners, and are they thinking ahead? Because I think the art of investing, again, if it's an anticipatory work, this is something that I learned from my dad years and years ago. You look ahead and you try to see the end from the beginning. Whatever that is, if you're looking at political altercations, if you're looking at geostrategic relations, if you're looking at market machinations, I mean, whatever this is, you try to see the end from the beginning and then step back to actions that need to be taken today.
Right.
So, I mean, the plain question for, I think, our listeners to consider is, do you now understand that one of the greatest wealth transfers in world history is unfolding in front of us right now? And if you have not already acted up to this point to protect assets, it's not too late. Although it's our opinion that it is getting later by the day.
Right.
And so I guess that's the question is what we have in front of us, barring the discussions from the FOMC, at the end of the month, we've got Jackson Hole. So the Fed's got another opportunity to do some sort of a Hail Mary if necessary. We'll just have to wait and see. Do you realize it's insignificant? We're dealing with a bankrupted company. This is corporation, USA.
Right.
And our shares are being sold off in the markets today. You know, while the Dow goes up 400 points on the back of the FOMC announcement, did you see what the dollar did?
It just tanked.
It's in the toilet, Kevin. Yeah. It's getting flushed. You're watching people overseas say, we got it. We understand exactly what you're doing. We understand that this is positive for the equity markets in the short run.
Right.
We understand that being accommodative and being willing to step in, you may announce a quantitative easing three. We may understand that that is short-term beneficial to the bond market, but we understand the direction here. We understand that the dollar is going lower. That is a course that has already been set, Kevin.
And this is why gold and silver are going up, but there is a point, and you've brought this out in the past, there's a point when you start saying, all right, we're going to always keep a third in metals. We're always going to keep a third as that investment base. But a lot of these clients of ours who started with very little means, who are people of means at this point, this last decade has been very good for the person who had a triangular strategy, let's say. They've maybe lost a little bit in the stock market, but they've made, well, they've quadrupled or quintupled in gold. It's gotten to be that big. Now,
well,
there is a reallocation time.
It's certainly not the case on our wealth management platform. I mean, it's not necessary to lose money in challenging times. It
right.
is necessary to remain engaged and assume that the market is going to do you no favors. And I think that's the disconnect with most Wall Street firms, is you're betting on, quote-unquote, the market, and that's the problem.
Right, and I was talking about people who don't have money with wealth management. I mean, the wealth management platform has done very well even in the crisis years. But even still, let's say that that wasn't the case. Let's say that there was a loss on one side of the triangle. The triangle grows and expands in ways that sometimes has to be reallocated. And, you know, this is where I was going with the exit strategy. We always recommend a third in insurance, but Dave, when do people actually start look at reducing their gold position a little bit and moving into other areas?
That's a question I'm getting a lot these days, Kevin, because certainly as the price of gold gets higher, I was on with CNBC this morning, and Market Watch asked the same question. What is your idea of the direction of gold from here? I mean, surely it can't go higher than it already is. I mean, the challenge intellectually is to see that this may in fact be a low price, not a high price.
Right.
And again, I think all of these judgments are based on a particular solid reference point. We're watching this happen right now, Kevin, with the downgrade in U.S. debt from AAA to AA+. This is an issue. We took the plumb line, which everyone measures risk against, and we changed the plumb line, which changes the way everything else is measured. Kevin, this is the knock-on effect. We've got downgrades which have begun in Oceanside, California, in Atlanta, Georgia, Miami, Florida, Irving, Texas. There's about 1,000 individual issues, just as the tip of the iceberg, which have already received the same downgrade from AAA rated. These are municipal bonds, were AAA, now they're AA+. Kevin, this is the issue.
So the dominoes have begun to fall. It's not just a U.S. government debt default, which I should say has always been treated as the risk-free trade. In other words, if you're going to get out of anything that has risk and go somewhere, historically people have just gone to treasuries because they say, well, it's a risk-free trade. A little more dangerous might be municipals, but those have been downgraded as well. And then we've got Ginny Mae, Freddie, and, you know, you've got the mortgage downgrades. But something interesting, Dave, and you can jump back in on this. But Warren Buffett came out and said that this S&P downgrade was politicking, okay, that it was just bending to the Tea Party people. But what's interesting is Moody's and Fitch, these guys haven't downgraded. In fact, Moody's came back in and said, no, they're still AAA. But guess who owns Moody's?
Tell me.
Berkshire.
Oh.
Which is Buffett.
Well, isn't that curious?
Isn't that something that Buffett is, you know, and he's, let's face it, Buffett has not been the genius that everybody paints him out to be. In 2008, he completely missed the fall that we're seeing, right? In 2008, he completely missed the crash. At this point, he's saying, you know, don't bet on a down economy for the United States government.
Kevin, so here's the genius of Buffett.
Right.
He knows when to be in the market and when not to be in the market. When he originally started investing, he determined that early on, he was smack dab in the middle of a bear market, and he gave investor money back, and he called it quits. He closed the business and walked away.
Right.
But let's not mistake brains for a bull market, because what did he do when we came into the bull market in the 80s? He began to find undervalued companies, and he participated in the revaluation of those companies to higher and premium numbers. But guess what was supporting his success?
Well, it was the greatest bull market in American history.
And is it any surprise that he's having a hard time making money in the last 10 years? Granted, he has a few companies that throw off a tremendous amount of cash flow. Those were some of his crown jewels, if you will, in terms of purchases. But I guess, Kevin, whether it's mistaking brains for a bull market or treating hope as an investment strategy.
Well, is hope an investment strategy?
And no. I mean, we have some investors who are paralyzed by making decisions even under normal circumstances, Kevin, let alone in challenging times. Others seem to think that the world should function in accord with their expectations. It's usually a fairly sheltered individual, I must say. But, Kevin, it's those people that simply cannot believe that events would occur in a manner inconsistent with what they anticipated.
David, what it reminds me of is you saw the movie Titanic, and they did a great job of showing the disbelief in the captain's face. You know, that boat was not going to sink, not under his watch.
Not yeah. my boat. I've studied the diagrams. I know how this boat was made.
Right. He couldn't believe it.
Not possible. And by the way, not this captain. I was chosen to be the special one. I was chosen to navigate these waters because I am the best. And I can't have my boat sink. This strange disbelief, Kevin, where it's simply not possible that I'm wrong because my construct, my right. belief in view of the world as X, Y, or Z, it's unchangeable, it's immutable, it's perfect.
Well, like you talked about with Martinson last week, I mean, that is the narrative. We all have a narrative, what we see as normal, and the narrative is that everything's going to be fine. We're just in another fluctuation on the up or downside.
And Kevin, I keep on encountering Wall Street brokers that pretend to be the captain of a ship with no real sense for piloting whatsoever. And I wonder, is it deluded to think, not my boat?
Right.
Not this captain. And yet exactly, it is, the context is different. We do have massive icebergs, Kevin. They have to be avoided at all costs. That's why our fixation for the last decade or even four has been on preservation of wealth, with growth being a secondary motive.
Okay, Dave, I want to go back to the narrative question, because we really do all operate with a particular paradigm and a particular narrative. We've talked about Structures of Scientific Revolution book, Thomas Kuhn, and how long it takes to change our mind on something, or black swans when all you've ever seen is a white swan. I mean, the narrative that's going on right now is costing people tremendously as far as their future wealth.
Yeah, I've been impressed of late with the power of self-deception. Reminded of some papers that I wrote back in the college days. I had one combined course. It was a psychology, theology, and philosophy course, and the paper was on self-deception.
Huh.
And, the single best class I took in 4 years, we looked at the ability of an individual to devise an imagined reality, which becomes concrete in the mind's eye, something that they can bear witness to, swear is true, and yet it's based on either false inputs or misinterpretations of reality. And I look at Wall Street today, and I think they're living a self-deceived existence where it simply cannot be the case.
Right.
Again, the captain is telling himself, I know this boat from stem to stern. I know this boat. I saw it built. I was there. We launched it. It's not possible. Not on my watch. I'm the best captain in the world. And this is the kind of belief, Kevin, that dies hard. And again, coming back to the concept that hope is not an investment strategy for an individual to look squarely in the eyes of their broker and say, you don't have a clue. And I'm very uncomfortable in this moment because while I thought that you knew more than I did, it turns out that you know less than I do because you can't even tap common sense in this moment.
Well, and it reminds me, Dave, that you have to have some sort of basis that is outside of yourself to check your facts. I'm thinking of the Bible right now. In 1 Thessalonians 5, Paul says, test all things and hold fast to that which is good. And in Acts, he says, those in Berea were more noble than those in Thessalonica because they heard what was said with readiness of mind. And then they checked the scriptures daily to see if what was said was true. So they didn't even trust themselves. They didn't even trust what Paul was saying without going back and saying, wait, this is what we have accepted as our structure of belief. And when it comes to the markets, there are historics that you can go back and look at. There are ratios that you can go back and look at. There's, like you talked about, there's psychology that you can go back and look at. But you have to be careful with the narrative and say, am I deceiving myself?
Yeah, and I think, Kevin, we have groups focusing on primary issues in the markets today. Of course, we had a downgrade last week, and CNN Friday night shortly after that declared that the downgrade was already priced into the market. There would be nothing right. significant that happened because it was already priced into the market.
I guess they were wrong.
Well, you know, first day of trade since going back to 1941 where we're not AAA rated and it's supposed to be priced in.
Right.
Yeah, that's yeah, the irony is that what was priced in was the inevitable, quote unquote, inevitable recovery, with a double dip being the view of wingnuts and Tea Party freaks.
Yeah, the Tea Party freaks are going to take the blame for everything real probably for the next 2 years.
Right, right. Well, you know, and as a reminder, I mean, the debt ceiling was never the issue. I guess we've said that already, but deficit spending is catching up with us
right.
and negatively compounding the debt burden we already carry. We've got deficit projections, which are a trillion plus per year for a decade. Did we mention that they were assuming positive growth in all of their projections? So take away the positive growth and your deficit projections per year end up being, oh, larger than otherwise assumed. So how quickly do we get hit by the exponential growth curve when we're looking at our national debts, Kevin? I mean, and so this is something that I think investors are realizing. And what are they opting for? They're opting for gold.
Right.
Again, the U.S. downgrade issue is, frankly, what our foreign creditors are concerned about. There's really a bifurcation here, Kevin, of people who are looking at us from an external perspective and then those from the inside perspective.
Okay. Now, Dave, I'm going to cut you off here because the Americans, the people here in the United States responded one way a couple of days ago, and everybody else responded another. Okay, when money was coming out of the stock market in America, it was just going right into those bonds that had just been downgraded, those treasury bonds.
Which is ironic, because if you look at Greece, if you look at Spain, if you look at Portugal, if you look at anyone who's had a downgrade in the last several years, credit rating goes down. Yields go up, price of the bonds goes down.
Right.
Investors in those bonds are losing money. Now, how does this happen? In the United States, credit rating goes down, bond prices go up, yields go down. This actually doesn't make sense, except when you look at the difference in behavioral patterns, Kevin, international versus domestic. The managed money crowd, so these would be your institutional money managers, have a schema in mind that when equities come under pressure, you rotate to a less pressured environment, which would be fixed income. And
right.
in this case, you're prioritizing liquidity, so you move into twos, fives, and 10-year treasuries.
That's what they've been taught all their life.
And that's what they did.
Yeah.
Now, in the international markets, you saw a little trickle into treasuries and a lot of trickle into German bonds and a lot of trickle into gold.
Well, and even the Swiss franc. I mean, let's face it, the Swiss are trying to devalue their currency. They're doing everything they can. They're like, stop buying our currency.
Holy cow. You wouldn't believe the Swiss franc this week. It's unbelievable.
Right.
I mean, it's as unbelievable as the move in gold. And what it says is that there's a number of operators in the world today who are looking past the smoke and mirrors,
right.
who could care less about a 400-point recovery in the Dow, and they say, that's great. That helps me with my exit strategy. I need to get out of dollars. I need to get out of U.S.-denominated paper. I don't want to own equities. I don't want to own bonds. And if the market is going to give me a gift, I, by all means, will take it. And Kevin, I think when you look at these moves in parallel, there's a very interesting commentary to develop from it. We don't have a strong treasury market, even though prices are reaching record highs.
Right.
We have a gutted treasury market as far as external sources of funds are concerned. It's the internal behavioral models that we see driving money out of equities into treasuries. Externally, Kevin, we're going to have a harder and harder time in the coming days, weeks, months, and years financing our deficits on the backs of our foreign creditors. They're the ones who looked at that U.S. downgrade and said, balderdash.
Yeah, not treasuries for me. I'm going to go to gold this time.
Priced into the market. Priced into the market. I think not. And so there is a real difference between the themes that are developing in the individual investor community, and I would include the individual investor community with the international investor community, where they're saying, listen, we're the creditors. It's our money you're playing with. Of course we care what your credit rating is. And it's the debtor on the other side that says, we're the debtor. It's your money we're playing with. Do we really care what we're rated? we don't care. It's not a big deal, and you should not worry. Kevin, it's ironic that the debtors are telling the rest of the world there's nothing to be concerned about, and the creditors are saying, oh, my word, this is utterly insane.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. So I can tell my bank if I'm not paying my mortgage, I can basically tell the bank, hey, don't worry about it. You got to understand.
I'm as bad as I've ever been.
That's exactly right.
Which may or may not be the truth. I mean, I'm not trying to throw tomatoes at you, but...
Right. Well, okay, let's go to the downgrades then. We just touched on it before, but this really is a series of dominoes that have to fall, isn't it? I mean, the U.S. debt downgrade is probably step one in a number of other, maybe even weaker securities. And, you know, if you could possibly go into that,
sure.
I think
and
people who own these things need to know.
Yeah, we've said this for weeks. This had nothing to do with default. There was no option of default. There would have been prioritized payments. There would have been a number of other alternatives. Default was never in the cards. Downgrade, of course.
Right.
We said that several weeks ago. Downgrade, of course. Why hasn't it happened sooner?
Right.
That's the question. And why did it stop at AA+? Because it could be a lot lower if you're looking at our balance sheet with an accurate appraisal. So, yeah, you look at our debt rating was AAA. Now it's AA+.
Right.
And what are the implications? Kevin, first of all, mortgage-backed securities. We have a system of debt which is tied and related to the Treasury. You know, specifically when you look at financing a mortgage, it is most sensitive to fluctuations in the 10-year Treasury.
Right.
You're telling me that with a downgrade and ultimately an increase in the cost of capital to finance debt, that that's not going to impact mortgage-backed securities at some point. That's not something that will happen today, but eventually you will see the knock-on effect from a downgrade in debt into the mortgage-backed security.
Well, then
market.
If we're connecting the dots, that's Fannie Mae and Freddie after that, is it not?
It is, and immediately it has affected their bonds. It won't affect all, again, mortgage paper per se, but it is affecting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac paper already. You know, you're talking about a basic existential insecurity. Think of it this way, Kevin. I mean, you know, again, if you want to look at mortgage-backed securities and assume that they're going to go unscathed, this idea of an existential insecurity. If a parent dies or your parent is incapacitated, your structure of security, what you counted on, sort of the implicit identity or you, where you've explicitly relied on them, when they disappear, you're talking about a major psychological realignment.
It's a real maturation process, let's face it.
Isn't it the same when all of the implicit or explicit guarantees tied to the U.S. government get readjusted when the debt is readjusted?
Well, and we've talked about before the difference between this, you know, federal government types of paper, which can be monetized, versus, say, municipalities, which these guys can't print money. I mean, let's face it, La Plata County, Durango, Denver, you know, Detroit, they can't print money. They either pay their bills or they default.
Well, and the argument goes that they've already made some tough decisions and cut expenses already. But the problem is they still face declining revenues in a recessionary environment. If investor perception has shifted back to a double-dip mentality, you can be guaranteed that the consumer will avoid all discretionary spending.
Sure.
So you're looking at revenues, both business and tax revenues, taking a downgrade. Yeah, we mentioned earlier the downgrades have begun for select issues, Oceanside, California, Atlanta, Georgia, Miami, Florida, Irving, Texas. Yeah, actually, we could give you, we don't have time to go through the list because actually there's about 1,000 individual issues.
It'd be like Johnny Cash's I've Been Everywhere. You know, it'd be the whole song.
Right.
Okay, now, the reality of a double-dip recession. I mean, this is something that we're starting to hear a lot in the mainline media.
And this is, I think, the difference, Kevin, between the way overseas markets have adjusted their appraisal of risk in the marketplace, and they are looking at the downgrade as a significant issue, whereas the U.S. investor community is writing that off. Again, this is the debtor saying, are you kidding me? Nothing's changed. We're going to pay our bills. Don't worry if we're a little late. Don't worry if our credit's been impaired. It was only a few points. Don't hold that against us. The debtor is begging off the issue. The creditor sees it for what it is. A downgrade is a downgrade is a downgrade.
Right.
Here domestically, what we are focused on is the reality of a double dip.
Yeah.
It's re-entered the consciousness of the investing public, and we did see a strong rotation from equities to bonds, not as a reaction to the downgrade, but to the notion that happy days may not be here again.
Right.
And it'll be a long time to fix the real economy, to repair the jobs market, to rebuild demand for housing. And I mean, just to linger on this point, it's a decidedly U.S. institutional bias that immediately rotates from equities to fixed income. We mentioned this just a few minutes ago. Assume it was Greece being downgraded, or Spain, or Portugal, or Ireland. And you were all too familiar with these cases from the past 6, 12, 18 months. You see a rise or a fall in rates. Exactly. You see a rise in rates. So increased demand for debt obligations? No, it's a decrease in demand. The difference in the U.S. for fixed income is that fixed income is the first choice of a misinformed asset manager.
Well, it's habit. It's habit. That's what we were talking about earlier in a meeting. You know, people do what is habitually right, and they're going to go to fixed income if they're not going to be in volatile types of ups and down types of investments.
The only thing that can be said positively about that judgment is that it prioritizes short-term liquidity over long-term solvency. And
sure,
they're assuming that, hey, if we get through this, then we can ask the solvency question, but for now we need to prioritize liquidity. So a move to treasuries is justifiable on the basis of liquidity, but it does completely ignore the medium and long-term issues of solvency.
Well, we've been very critical about the United States monetization of so much of this debt. I mean, it's catching up to us in the form of inflation here, but especially inflation overseas. And you've talked about how the international markets react a little bit different. They feel that inflation first in the dollar. So they go buy gold or they go buy Swiss francs. But the European Central Bank, Dave, they're following in our footsteps.
Exactly. We saw this, actually wrote about it this last week in our Friday comments, that the ECB was monetizing debt aggressively, that they began with Portuguese and Irish debt and extended it to Italian and Spanish debt thereafter. They're buying bonds just like we have been buying bonds, like QE1 and QE2.
You're
we
right.
know this is inflationary. We see the Bundesbank fuming. The German, domestic German bank is absolutely going crazy because Trichet has called the shots on this, and they're not happy. They know that it's inflationary, and it's a real concern.
Well, and Citigroup, I mean, they're not necessarily the bastions of wisdom, but these guys have looked at it, and they've said, this thing's going to take $2.5 trillion to even come close to starting to solve the problem.
Well,
is Europe ready to do that?
Kevin, just to clarify, it's not $2.5 trillion that Citigroup sees as a necessary bailout fund for Europe. It's 2.5 trillion euros.
Which would top three for us.
Yeah, so add 40%.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Kevin, concern Europeans bought German bonds and gold. The ECB is monetizing in where you want to go. You want to focus on your best bets. In Europe, that's Germany. And in the world over, it still is gold. We have inflation, Kevin, and it's a global issue. We have competitive devaluation, and it's a global issue. We have pressures in the dollar. We have, of course, pressures with the euro. And we have investors, individual investors, trying to make clear-headed decisions in this environment. Again, we come back to what's your reference point.
Right.
We look at the Dow gold ratio as being absolutely critical, both to a purchase now and a liquidation tomorrow. Not as in tomorrow, Thursday, Friday of this week, but as in tomorrow, a future date, which may be months or years away. There is a discipline, and that's what we're implying. And there is a discipline when you begin to create a structure, an asset allocation model, which takes into account both inflationary outcomes, deflationary outcomes, and growth-oriented positive, hey, we're not just bad news bears, outcomes in the economy.
Yeah.
This is, I think, where investors are struggling. What's our strategy? How do we do this? What does this look like? Because, again, as they walk into their money manager or to their broker, they see this panicked look in their eye. And just as you mentioned, the high trilling voices of CNBC and Bloomberg, that's what they're getting with everyone they know who's associated with Wall Street. A little bit of desperation because actually they don't know what's happening.
Well, and David, speaking of desperation, okay, there are a lot of people who aren't investors. There are a lot of people who just live paycheck to paycheck and they're angry. I'm thinking about this Rasmussen poll right now. There's a poll out that I think all of our listeners need to Google. And you just type in Rasmussen and you can type in 17% after that and it'll come up. Rasmussen 17%, 2011 if you want to. But people are angry, Dave. Would you describe what that poll is saying?
Yeah, in the opinion of one professional pollster, this is pre-revolutionary, in his words. There's only 17% of those in this poll think that government has the consent of the governed, which is very powerful.
17%
of those polled think that government has the consent of the governed. And this is even more interesting, Kevin, with only 6% polled thinking that Congress is doing its job.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, that's pre-revolutionary. If you're currently a part of the political monopoly, and we're talking about the two-party system, you've got to be asking yourself the question, how do we ensure this duopoly and keep out any challengers, whether it's the Tea Party crowd or what have you? I guess what we're suggesting is, politicians are reading this poll and they realize that things are going to have to get nasty if the power elite are going to keep their franchise. I think you're talking about a fight between here and 2012.
Well, what's amazing about this poll, Dave, is when you're talking 17% of the Americans believe that the government's actually representing them, you're talking Democrats and Republicans and Tea Party people. We're talking about everybody in that basket because 17% does not represent any one group. David, I'm thinking of something that a liberal Washington Post columnist wrote about Obama. He says, the economy crawls, the credit rating falls, the markets plunge, and a helicopter packed with U.S. special forces goes down in Afghanistan. Two-thirds of the Americans are saying the country's on the wrong track, and that was before the market swooned. He says, Obama plods along, raising gobs of cash for his reelection bid. And he was scheduled to speak at two DNC fundraisers Monday night. And varying little the words that he reads from the teleprompter. So even the Democrats, even the liberals are going, wait a second, who are these guys? There's a huge disconnect.
Kevin, going back to that idea of the consent of the governed and very few feeling like they're being represented, you have political party A, you have political party B, and you have the middle class, which is saying, I think the politicos are going to need a message. They're feeding at the trough while we, the middle class, are paying a very steep price for the overextended promises and poor planning in both the fiscal and monetary areas.
Right.
So what happens in the next election cycle is largely a replacement of inept leadership. Is that the story? Is that the story for 2012 as we head into the election? I think certainly there's growing angst. And again, you look at the Rasmussen poll and you say, wow, 17%? That represents the majority on the other side who have major problems with the way things are being handled. And that's the way they're being handled by both Republicans and Democrats.
Well, David, obviously the solution is not going to come in the hands of the politicians that exist right now. So we have to wait at least a year and a half before anything starts to change that direction. But one of the things that we can predict is the predictable behavior of the Federal Reserve. I mean, they're only given so many tools. They can either lower or raise interest rates, or they can do something about creating money. I mean, there are different mechanisms to do it, but those are really the two things. They're just there to inflate, basically.
Yeah, and I think that's what remains predictable behavior, Kevin. Supporting asset prices at the expense of the dollar, I think, was probably the most predictable thing coming into this FOMC meeting, and certainly looking ahead to Jackson Hole and the remainder of the year.
Right.
They will support stability, and I think you'll find market stability. The cost for that will be in the U.S. dollar. Just to play devil's advocate here, Kevin, I mean, let's imagine the mind of the Fed chief. Deflation sensitive.
Sure.
Inflation hawk, surrounded by inflation doves, a clear majority of doves all across the regional Fed banks. What happens between now and the end of the year is probably not going to look like 1937. We can say that much.
Now, 1937, please give us an example of 1937 so that our listener can correlate that with now.
Yeah, the tightening of monetary policy in 37 is believed by some to have relapsed the economy into a decline like that of the earlier period in the 30s. That's highly unlikely, Kevin, given the leadership that we have at the Fed today.
So, David, what you're saying is deflation or tightening up on the dollar is a very low probability at this point.
Yeah, if you look at 37, I mean, that's sort of the classic behavior that Bernanke wants to avoid. He doesn't want to tighten at just the wrong time. He's going to accommodate beyond when he probably should.
Right.
Tempting the deflationary fates seems a very low probability event. He's going to choose the lesser of two evils, looking at inflation and deflation, and putting in a high level of confidence in the machinery, both the mental machinery amongst all the PhDs there, as well as their actual credit-creating machinery. And I think that's what they're going to assume, is that they can control inflation, they can leave the bias towards accommodation. If they need to, between now and Jackson Hole or after in Jacksonville, they can announce asset purchases, liquidity provisions, or other temporary market manipulations, Kevin, to keep basically investor sentiment buoyed. But no, they're not going to let deflation occur on Bernanke's watch.
Well, and you know, I think we should talk just briefly before we finish the show up of what are the options that the Fed has. I mean, what is in the toolbox? Because, you know, this week there's been an awful lot of talk about this Federal Open Market Committee announcement, but in reality, Jackson Hole is coming up in 2 or 3 weeks, and Bill King said that that's been critical. You know, Jackson Hole was where quantitative easing was announced back in 2010. It was the last part of August last year. It's the last part of August this year. This is where the brain trust, if you want to call it that, gets together and they say, okay, what do we really need to do and how do we announce it?
I think some of the probable things to occur, if we begin to see a crack up with certain financial institutions here in the U.S., you'll go back to asset swaps where, you know, the balance sheet of the Fed remains the same, but they swap short-dated paper for long-dated paper, or swap quality paper to put on the bank balance sheet and take on the toxic paper onto the Fed balance sheet. So, you know, it just relieves pressure in the marketplace.
Well, and then there's interest rates, and they've already said they're not going to raise interest rates.
Right. I mean, that's an option, but again, looking at our outstanding debt, that creates more of a problem for them in terms of an increased cost of borrowing on the existing debt and a harder time rolling over existing debt. So it squeezed the equity markets. I think that's the one thing that they would not want to do.
Sure.
Raising rates at this point would squeeze the equity markets, which would be counterproductive. I guess the third option would be to quit paying on excess reserves. They've got roughly, banks across the country have roughly $1.6 trillion in excess reserves.
Well, and they're getting a quarter of a point on that from the Federal Reserve, just having it in reserve.
Yeah, so the Fed can say, no, to stimulate the economy, what we're going to do is change course there and quit paying or reduce the payment on excess reserves. And that, in theory, would encourage the banks to start lending again.
Right.
The point being, Kevin, is that they would try to stimulate lending and thus the economy by ending their excess reserve subsidy, if you will.
So the idea is, if I'm a banker and I'm making a quarter of a percent risk-free, basically, from the Federal Reserve, and I'm sitting on excess reserves, that's what I'm making. If they cut that down, this is one of the things that we've talked about possibly launching this money that's been held back, almost like water behind a dam, into the economy. Now, it seems like that's a double-edged sword, Dave. In one respect, you would have a recovery feel when you had all that liquidity get loaned out, but wouldn't that spark an inflationary run that we've never seen before?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of the tsunamis that we've had, you know, 2004, and then more recently the one in Japan, you know, you've got this amazing surge, and the first look is this is interesting, and then it keeps on building and building and building and building. So, you know, the idea is that $1.6 trillion in excess reserves actually has a significantly larger footprint in the marketplace, as much as 7 to 10 times, at least according to a finance prof friend of mine, 25 years of finance prof all around the world. He does private consulting today.
So what he's saying is $1.6 trillion could turn into more than $10
trillion
worth of rotation,
trillion.
Right?
Exactly,
okay.
$16 trillion of rotation. So what seems on the front end positive as it slowly trickles out of bank reserves into the economy ends up being hyperinflationary,
yeah.
A bit of a problem. Yes, that's the death of the dollar. Yes, you want to own gold in that environment. Again, it's a theoretical concept tied to the velocity of money and an extreme increase in the velocity of money. So, you know, there's point and counterpoint to that, Kevin.
Sure.
Maybe they do take away the 25 basis points they're paying. Maybe they just leave it as it is.
Well, there's another tool in the toolbox that we've really all learned the language of over the last couple of years, and that's quantitative easing. Now, the question has been to many of our guests, and it's still in the mind, I know I'm thinking about it, is quantitative easing 3 right around the corner. Is that something that you think may be announced after Jackson Hole?
Kevin, I think what's interesting is that QE1 was effective. QE2 was unnecessary.
Right.
And QE3 has been utterly discredited as something that could happen in the future. Unless, of course, there is an adequate amount of pain to justify any activity in the marketplace. And I think this is what's very interesting about a democracy and a place where we have largely freedom of the press. When you begin to get the vibe that the general public isn't happy, and in fact they could erupt volcanically if something is not done now, that's when the Fed may just say, yeah, QE3 makes a lot of sense,
right,
and we're just going to spend a lot of money that we don't have, and yes, that's called monetization, and you're going to love it.
Yeah.
You're going to love it because you're asking for it, and you're on the hook for it, and it was your idea, and we're just going along with the general zeitgeist.
Well, inflation does not hurt in the beginning. Inflation actually makes you feel better. It's a little bit like taking that extra shot of whiskey for the alcoholic, but it's not going to solve the problem.
Pain is something that redefines legitimacy, and I think that's what we have to keep an open mind to. What will the Fed do? It depends on the circumstances at the time. It really depends on the circumstances at the time. If the market's relatively normal by the time we get to Jackson Hole, nothing will be done.
Right.
If we're going nuts and we've lost 2,000 points on the Dow and we're scraping close to 9,500, you're going to see the whites in their eyes, you're going to see the sweat beating on their foreheads, and they're going to do what any smart person would do, spend money you don't have.
Yeah.
I mean, put the fix in, get the plunge protection team to work. How much liquidity do you need? Where do you need it? We can apply, and we've seen this because we saw this in 2008, we'll see them make available trillions that you can't imagine existing. They were at one point making available close to $30 trillion in liquidity, Kevin. Now, you say, well, it didn't even exist. You're right. It didn't even exist. And that's what it took to soothe and to calm the market nerves in 2008. You think that's off the table for 2011 or 2012?
Probably not.
Absolutely not. But pain will define their course from this point forward. Corporate and national pain, because that's the only thing that they can hide against or hide under.
So, David, coming full circle to end the program up, if you've got someone who's looking at you right now over the table saying, you know, I'm hearing all this crazy noise, what do I do?
I think the first thing that you do, Kevin, is take a look at the DVD we just produced this year. It's free.
Right.
We send it out to hundreds of thousands of people all over the world. If you haven't seen it, you can watch it online or you can request a physical copy of it. And just get some perspective. Take an appraisal of where we're at and where we're going. Make sure that you've got decent facts in front of you before you start strategizing. And then begin to strategize. Begin to put together an asset allocation that is bulletproof, that works under any circumstances, good, bad, ugly. And I think begin to adopt the disciplines necessary to succeed in a very challenging economic environment. Things are going to get a lot worse before they get multiples better. And I do think things are going to get a lot better, a whole lot better, but not before we see a tremendous squeeze in the political system, a tremendous squeeze in the financial system, a tremendous squeeze in the stock and bond markets. And I just hope that folks are keeping level heads and setting about this the right way, with a strong strategy and a strong frame of reference.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call, especially for the DVD, at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.